From a secret location somewhere in America, this is your Chill Pack
Hollywood.
Hollywood Hour.
I'm leaving.
Your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. I'm Phil Lairness. I'm hungover.
I'm Dean Haglund.
I'm hungover, and that's Dean Haglund, no longer down under. So I don't even feel like, I feel like I should retire the Mujahideen moniker, even.
I think so.
Yeah.
Now it's Motown Dean.
Well, you're from a secret location at this point, because we're not quite sure where you're bunkered at this moment.
No, neither am I. It's a roving caravan of stuff and socks that across the Midwest somehow.
Oh, well, that's the caravan that the president so worried about. He was badly misinformed. A caravan of dirty socks from Australia does seem to pose some significant threats to our health, our economy, and our way of life.
Our biosecurity, it's in reverse. It could be full of funnel spiders, for all I know.
Oh, boy.
I haven't checked them.
So early in a show, so early on a Sunday morning to dip our toes into current events. All I want to say, Dean Haglund, is honestly, first of all, welcome back to America, where we have mass shootings and mass bomb scares, and that was just my engagement party last night.
Oh, it was your engagement party last night. How fun was that?
I'm feeling how fun it wasn't at this particular moment. Much of this episode of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour will be brought to you by tequila.
No, you're not still drinking. It's morning time.
No, I'm still running on those fumes, man.
Oh,
man.
Right.
You know, a really well mixed margarita is so smooth and just packs a wallop afterwards, doesn't it?
Well, it does, because the sugar hides how much alcohol is in there. That's what I always think. I'm suspicious of sugary drinks like margaritas, because there's always something hidden beyond the sugar that you only pay for in the morning.
Well, and people. Yes. You're suspicious of sugary people. I mean, this is why you are not flowery in your language, and you're not overly sweet to people. In fact, you're rather brusque and abrasive. And yet,
am I? And no,
yet,
I thought that was you.
That's the worst that it gets. is it me? I don't know. Maybe it is me. You might be right.
I think it's you.
You, me. I don't know where I end and you begin. So.
Oh, my God. Oh, you are hungover.
You're
Holy
the
smokes.
One who said when we were testing levels that we're getting a place together, and that was news to me.
No. I was talking. We're looking for, when I said we, not you and me.
All right. Enough about my Dia de los Muertos adventures. Dia de los Muertos themed engagement party called Till Death Do Us Part is for Quitters. And you've seen a photo, Dean, that I don't know. It changed your way of life. I don't know. I got nothing. But enough about me. You went on a crazy. I want to hear all about your American adventures thus far. But can we start with the crazy breakneck road trip you took, excursion to Washington D.C. and back?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, Washington. Let's say it was Gainesville, Virginia, or Tyson's Corner. There's a lovely area called Tyson's.
It's lovely place, but the worst traffic, like right there, anywhere in the world.
It's on Tyson's Corner.
I had the hardest time getting out of Tyson's Corner when I got off the freeway inadvertently and needed to get out of Tyson's. And I felt like there should have been a sign, you are now leaving Tyson's Corner, don't let the door hit you.
It's for locals only. That is true. There's not a plethora of road signs, and there's a elevated people mover now, a SkyTrain of some sort that wasn't there when I was there. So yes, quite different.
I believe your fellow groomsman at my wedding And the author and performer of multiple Chill Pack Hollywood Hour theme songs now, with yet another one coming. John Lawler, formerly of the B-Film Extras, way back when worked at an Apple store in Tyson's Corner.
Really? In that big mall? Whatever the Tyson's Corner Mall is? Forget what it's called.
Answer me this. Do you think there has been a moment in the first 5 minutes of the show that's been of interest to any listeners?
Bet people who live in Tyson's Corner are fascinated.
Oh, my God, that's true. The free publicity we just gave Apple.
They're going to rush to Tyson's Corner to see what we're talking about.
So why did you go down? You went down there. Now, Patty's from not far from there, right?
Well, she worked in that area back in the day, and her brother is still there, and family and stuff. So we went specifically to buy, well, we bought a car sight unseen, and we went to pick it up and then drive that car back to Michigan, because throughout the entire Penske chain, that was the only one that ticked all our boxes. It was over in Tyson's Corner. So we flew one way for, what was that, a two-hour trip, and then drove 8 hours back in the brand-new car that we got. Well, it wasn't brand-new. It was used, 18,000 miles on it. But we put another 400 on it right away. So
now, what was the eight-hour drive? Now, you've driven many parts of this country.
Yes.
But I imagine D.C. to Detroit offered some new thoroughfares.
Very new thoroughfares. Yeah, we stayed on the 70, mostly going through Pennsylvania, Apple Country. Oh my gosh, Apple Country, beautiful. The trees just turning apples. Every stand, every gas station had apple harvest like a crazy. Apple jams, apple butters, as far as the eye could see, till you get to the Allegheny Mountains where it was snowing. At 2,400 feet, there was snow in October in the Allegheny Mountains. So we drove through that and then came out on the other side of Pittsburgh, where it sort of leveled out. And from there, through the Rust Belt, seeing the mighty places of industry. And oddly enough, there's a NASA research facility up in that area. I don't know what they're researching, but it's over there.
It's interesting. And, I forget, you know, because I'm in Los Angeles, I forget, of course. Yeah, you were treated to a lot of colors, a lot of autumnal colors.
A lot of autumnal colors. It's very beautiful here right now.
And so when, you know, you'd stopped off in L.A., but L.A. is, again, its own ecosystem in a weird way.
Yes.
And so was it... was it markedly different doing that drive from what anything you would see in Australia? I mean, did it make you feel like, wow, I really am in a different place again?
Yeah. Well, first off, snow. That's, you never see that in Australia, except if you go to the one ski hill in the entire country when it's super cold. They have a one ski hill in Australia, I think. Yeah, it is markedly different. It's also, you know, you're driving on the other side of the road. It's a four-lane freeway, something that doesn't really exist. And, of course, you drive the speed of the flow of the traffic, as opposed to Australia, where they're very strict and have lots of speed cameras, even on the freeways. So if it's crowded, if there's traffic jams, you don't go faster than the speed limit, even if it would help alleviate the clogging congestion. So, you know, it's all that stuff. It's kind of weird.
Is there passing in Australia?
There is, but if you speed up to pass on the freeway, you could potentially get ticketed by electronic. You know, by mail, they'll just mail you a $300 ticket. Yeah. So there's lots of speed cameras all over, and they're very strictly enforced on that one.
All right. We have a lot to get to, but has there been anything while you've been exploring your new home area there in Michigan, has there been anything that made you say, in the words of Dean Haglund, holy crap?
Every day I'm saying that, frankly, some surprises, some things. We just had, I've had a waffle and chicken sandwich at Tim Hortons, which looks big in the commercial, but it was, I've seen spiders bigger than that sandwich in Australia. And
That could still be a big sandwich.
It could still be a big sandwich. You're right. Yeah, maybe I'm using that as a bad analogy. But no, and our previous guest, Matty Giles, of course, him and I had a beer at a fun place, and he gave me the lowdown on what it is to be a local in Detroit. So getting my feet firmly planted in the Midwest is what's happening right now.
Love that guy, Matty Giles.
Yeah, love that guy. That was a good time.
Good. All right. Well, we need to kick off this chapter of your Chill Pack mm-hmm. Hollywood Hour. And when I say kick off, I mean you can have the show now because we took the first 11 minutes to ourselves with celebrity deaths.
Celebrity deaths.
So the first one is actually someone I knew, someone I got to meet and worked with briefly when I directed the behind-the-scenes documentary about one of her films. Writer-director Audrey Wells died of cancer at age 58. Her work included writing the big hit The Truth About Cats and Dogs. Remember the big sleeper hit with Janine Garofalo and Uma Thurman? She wrote the Brendan Fraser George of the Jungle. She wrote and directed Guinevere, which was a charming little movie that I did the behind the scenes for. That starred Sarah Pauley, you know, who I love. Stephen Ray. It was about a May-December romance. And I got to have a very fascinating conversation with Ms. Wells, and part of which makes it into the documentary. You know, the studios always have say over what you're allowed to use and what you don't. Fascinating interview I got to do with Jean Smart, who plays Sarah Pauley's mom in that movie, that the studio said, yeah, you're not allowed to use any of this, even though what she was saying really spoke to the themes of the film. But it was white patriarchy stuff she was talking about, and this was 17, 18 years ago, and that was seen as just, I don't know, rude at the time.
Really?
About some of these issues. One of the things that Jean Smart pointed out, and this isn't about Audrey Wells, but one of the things Jean Smart pointed out back then, which I thought was fascinating, was she mentioned that at that time, because we were talking about May-December relationships, and I think that that was relevant because that's what the movie was about, but the studio said no. Anyway, she pointed out that at that time, and who knows what it is now, but at that time, the average age difference between a man and a woman playing a married couple on screen was 18 years. And the average age difference between a man and a woman in America in real life who were married was 18 months.
Oh, wow. That's a fascinating
because of
statistic.
certain myths that have always been perpetuated within the film industry, right? Which has been run by old white men since the beginning. So Audrey Wells, some of her other movies, Under the Tuscan Sun, A Dog's Purpose, she wrote, which was a big hit last year, and her last project was writing the screenplay for The Hate U Give, a drama based on the 2017 novel by Angie Thomas. The movie was released one day after Audrey Wells died. It was released on October 5th. The Hate U Give has received very nice reviews from critics, hailing it as a powerful movie. It's about a black teenager who witnesses a police shooting and finds the strength to do the right thing. Audrey Wells was a UCLA grad, something we have in common, and she hailed from the San Francisco Bay Area, something else we had in common.
Audrey Wells.
You know that I love getting to talk about great character actors, and one of the most prolific of the last 40 years, especially, left us, James Caron.
James Caron.
Now, this is a man whose face was immediately recognizable But again, one of these great character actors where you're not really sure when you read the name.
Right.
He appeared in such movies as Wall Street, The China Syndrome, possibly best recognized for Poltergeist, where played the real estate developer who builds the residential community over a former cemetery.
Holy spoiler alert. What the hell?
Oh, my God. Oh, my Lord.
That's the whole movie. You just ruined it.
Oh, my God. There are some, you know, thrills and spooks and chills in the movie you can still enjoy. Mr. Karen was 94 years old. He had over 200 television and film credits. Long-running role on the soap opera All My Children. Some of my favorites. He played Hugh Sloan's lawyer in All the President's Men. He played the vice president in Capricorn One.
I
feel like I've been mentioning that movie an odd amount of times lately.
I know. It's come up a lot, hasn't it?
More recently, how about David Lynch's Mulholland Drive?
Yes, of course.
And then not a handful of years ago, the really affecting drama starring Will Smith, The Pursuit of Happiness.
Oh, yeah. I kind of like that one.
He was really, really good in it. So this guy was a great character actor. And what I love is he always played, it seemed anyway, in the roles that I remember, he always played people with some level of authority and some level of compassion. When those people were greedy or conniving. So in other words, he was great as playing crooked politicians because you understood something that you rarely get to understand when people are casting crooked politicians, because they're always casting really oily people, it seems.
Yeah.
You know, you almost see them twisting their mustache, right?
But, yeah, exactly.
But this guy was a glad-handing dandy with charm and who you understood why people would place their trust in. And at the same time, you would go, yeah, it's no real shock. He's conniving.
Right, right.
What a nifty trick to pull off.
Yeah, yeah. And how much work would you get if you had that combo going on?
You'd get so many things. More than 200 jobs, apparently.
Well, apparently. Fantastic.
Paul Allen, co-founder of Microsoft, who co-founded it with his childhood friend Bill Gates. When the duo started Microsoft in 1975, he died at age, 65?
65, that's kind of young.
Hodgkin's lymphoma. He was an interesting guy. In all the ways that Bill Gates really isn't interesting, Paul Allen
is interesting. You've been to his museum, right?
I have not been. No.
Oh, I thought when you were at the Seattle Space Needle, at the very base of it, the Frank Gehry Design Museum of sci-fi of artifacts that he's collected over the years are all on display there, including laser cannons from Forbidden Planet, original scripts from I think he had a Planet of the Apes script.
Okay. This is the Museum of Pop Culture. Is that what it is?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That one.
Yeah.
Have you been there?
I mean, I was outside it.
Well, that's a good start. Yeah.
Because, this guy loved rock and roll music.
Yeah. He's got a huge collection of guitars.
Well, he was an accomplished guitarist. He had a recording studio built on his yacht, by the way. Let's just think about that. And
place to record.
He made an album in 2013 that featured the Wilson Sisters of Heart. And his favorite musician, think about this, Jimi Hendrix was Paul Allen's favorite musician. And he once opened the Experience Music Project in Seattle that featured a large collection of Hendrix memorabilia. And that's how the Museum of Pop Culture begins.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Oh, I thought he just said, I got this huge collection of stuff. I better stuff it somewhere. And then he built a museum.
See, we each learned something about Paul Allen from the other. Dean Haglund, this is why we're such good co-hosts and why we'll be soon getting a place together.
No, we're not getting a place together. Let's clear that up.
He was also a major sports fan, owned the Seattle Seahawks and the Portland Trail Blazers. And let's face it, perhaps most important, a major philanthropist who donated billions of dollars with a B for various causes, including homelessness and environmental issues. And as I understand it, he was arranging his estate so that the vast majority of it would go to his charitable causes upon his death.
I think so. His work in environmental oceanic sciences was also well-renowned because he had a luxury submarine, a two-story submarine with a living room on the lower deck at the front with a 9-inch glass viewing window where they discovered many World War II relics when sailing around the South Pacific. Believe it or not.
And where he would say, no, 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 Mr. Bond, I expect you to die.
See, this is how, you know, multi-billionaires,
exactly.
They can either go either way. They either help oceanic environmental sciences or they
I guess it comes down to how good that music coming out of that recording studio on the yacht was, really, in terms of your determination. Is it turning the fish over? Are they flopping belly up, or are they swimming with a little more pep?
Swimming with you.
Yeah.
Yes. Are you being followed by a pod of orcas? Then you know you're killing it on the high registers.
Dean Haglund, this celebrity death comes to us from the land of my people, the land of my ancestors, Norway, don't you know?
Oh, I do.
Joachim Ronneberg was I'm sure I'm pronouncing that last name wrong, which is of shame to my ancestors, but I am hungover. So,
yeah, so you did that.
Which would be a source of pride for my ancestors. I don't know, are the Norwegians drinking people? Who knows? You must be to stave off that chill all the time. But
Yeah, in the land of the men, when there's an island that you can drink around the clock on when the midnight sun comes. I forget the name of it.
You mean literally like they're gathering hands in the town square and circling the clock and they're drinking. Who is Joachim Ronneberg, you ask? I'm so glad you did.
I do.
Dean. He was a World War II hero, a true hero, who led a team of five Norwegian resistance fighters on a daring raid to blow up the Nazi heavy water plant in German-occupied Norway. They were using heavy water there in an attempt to start atomic bomb production, and they were getting close, right?
Right.
As we know. Mm-hmm. It was that close, the razor's edge that would have tipped, obviously, the war in a different direction had they been allowed to complete their heavy water experiments. But they were not allowed to because Operation Gunnerside, which oddly enough was going to be the original name of this podcast, Operation Gunnerside.
right. We got a cease and desist on that, too.
Involved that five-man team parachuting into the mountains, then skiing during the night to the water plant. I mean, right there, like that's what your triathlon should be in the Olympics. Parachuting,
skydiving,
blowing
cross-country skiing,
a plant.
Blowing something up, and then they escape that
and then
way
you
too.
Have to escape. So they set off explosive devices after penetrating this heavily guarded plant and then chased by thousands of Nazi troops. The team skied hundreds of miles successfully into Sweden, only to find that they really didn't like it there. No, that's
not where the story goes.
No, it doesn't.
No.
The raid crippled the Nazis' abilities in their heavy water experiments. The operation has been recounted in books, documentaries, feature films, TV movies. Ronenberg led other brave missions, including blowing up important railway bridge used by Germans for supplies. He was awarded Norway's highest decoration for heroism, the War Cross with Sword, and after the war became a radio broadcaster.
I did not know that.
Yeah. I like to That's think that he was like a top 40. This is Joachim Ronenberg, you know.
How you doing?
Spinning exactly. the hits.
Speaking of the hits. And here with another explosive song.
Yeah.
Blowing it up.
Number one with charts. A bullet. All right.
See what you did?
I did. I regret it. All right.
You do.
And finally, Dean, because I want to get to movies, but as promised, mm-hmm. one of the greatest obituaries of all time. I teased you with this when we were high atop L.A.'s City Hall.
Oh, that's right.
And this obituary came from the Delaware Online, and it was for a man named Rick Stein. All right?
Rick Stein, okay.
I am going to, if you'll bear with me, and you'll appreciate this, if I want to take the time to do what I never do. I'm going to read the entire obituary to you, okay?
Wow, you never do that.
Rick Stein, 71, of Wilmington, was reported missing and presumed dead on September 27th, 2018, when investigators say the single-engine plane he was piloting, the Northrop, suddenly lost communication with air traffic control and disappeared over the Atlantic Ocean off the coast of Rehoboth Beach.
Right.
Philadelphia police confirmed Stein had been a patient at Thomas Jefferson University Hospital, where he was being treated for a rare form of cancer. Hospital okay. spokesman Walter Heisenberg says doctors from Stein's surgical team went to visit him on rounds when they discovered his room was empty. Security footage shows Stein leaving the building at approximately 3:30 Thursday afternoon, but then the video feed mysteriously cuts off.
That's cool.
Authorities say they believe Stein took an Uber to the Philadelphia airport, where they assume he somehow gained access to the aircraft.
I'm with you.
The sea was angry that day, said NTSB lead investigator Greg Fields in a press conference. We have no idea where Mr. Stein may be, but any hope for a rescue is unlikely.
There you go.
Stein's location, however, isn't the only mystery. It seems no one in his life knew his exact occupation.
What?
His daughter, Alex Walsh of Wilmington, appeared shocked by the news. My dad couldn't even fly a plane. He owned restaurants in Boulder, Colorado, and knew every answer on Jeopardy. He did the New York Times crossword in pen. I talked to him that day, and he told me he was going out to get some grappa. All he ever wanted was a glass of grappa. Stein's okay. brother, Jim, echoed similar confusion. Rick and I owned Stuart Kingston Galleries together. He was a jeweler and oriental rug dealer, not a pilot. Meanwhile, Missel Leddington of Charlottesville claimed her brother was a cartoonist and freelance television critic for The New Yorker.
What?
David Walsh, Stein's son-in-law, said he was certain Stein was a political satirist for the Huffington Post, while grandsons Drake and Sam said they believe Stein wrote an internet sports column for ESPN covering Duke basketball, FC Barcelona soccer, the Denver Broncos, and the Tour de France. Stein's granddaughter, Evangeline, claims he was a YouTube sensation who had just signed a seven-figure deal with Netflix.
Okay. Well, that one you can verify somehow.
So, do you want me to finish this? Keep going.
Yeah. Well,
okay. All right.
I don't think he's dead.
All right. When told of his uncle's wait till you hear about the wife. When told of his uncle's disappearance, Edward Stein said he was baffled, since he believed Stein worked as a trail guide in Rocky Mountain National Park. He took me on a hike up the Lily Peak Trail back in the 90s. He knew every berry, bush, and tree on that trail. Nephew James Stein of Los Angeles claimed his uncle was an A&R consultant for Bad Boy Records and ran a chain of legal recreational marijuana dispensaries in Colorado called, I kid you not, Casa Blunta. niece Courtney Stein, a former Hollywood agent, said her uncle had worked as a contributing writer for Seinfeld and Curb Your Enthusiasm and was currently consulting on a new series with Larry David. In fact, the only person who might be able to answer the question, who is the real Rick Stein, is his wife and constant companion for the past 14 years, Susan Stein. Detectives were unable to interview Mrs. Stein, however. Neighbors say they witnessed her leaving the home the couple shared wearing dark sunglasses and a fedora, loading multiple suitcases into her car. FAA records show she purchased a pair of one-way tickets to Rome, which was Mr. Stein's favorite city. An anonymous source with the airline reports the name used to book the other ticket was Juan Morford DeRode, which, according to the FBI, was an alias Stein used for many years.
Okay.
Okay, so wait a minute. The obituary continues. That is one story.
Oh, my God. No way.
Another story is that Rick never left the hospital and died peacefully with his wife and daughter holding tightly to his hands. You can choose which version you want to believe or share your own story about Rick with us at the Greenville Country Club on Friday, November 9th, 2018, from 3 to 6 p.m. So since I shared a little hint with you, Dean, a postscript about this obituary appeared in the Washington Post, who found out that that obituary was written by the first person mentioned other than Mr. Stein in that obituary, his daughter, Alex Walsh, who wrote it about her father, 71, a man who she told the Washington Post had an endless appetite for comedy. The huge response on social media has been comfort to the mourning family, she said, as people who never knew her father have been sending condolences by the dozens and have gotten some sense of his sense of humor.
Well, okay. So now that it was all a hilarious, crazy mix-up.
I like that there was enough of an inflection and a question mark in your voice.
Yeah.
Because you ultimately want to believe.
Yeah. I think he's in Rome and he faked everything. Wouldn't that be... And just got out. Was he in debt? Like what?
I think he died, and I think that this was her tribute to him.
Yeah, still pretty funny.
Very funny. All right, you know what else I didn't get to talk to you about, and I may have mentioned this in an email to you, but when we talked about It Happened One Night.
Yes.
And, you know, we were talking about the context of 30s films and Capra.
And Clark Gable,
The treatment of women in those movies. One thing we didn't mention, even when we talked about the famous scene where Gable takes off his shirt, revealing he's not wearing an undershirt, and then, as you pointed out, showing us a trope, maybe inventing a trope, although I'm sure it comes from the play, but that would become part of every sitcom for decades thereafter, where two people who are not married share a room, and they hang a rope in the middle and put a sheet over it to separate the room, right?
Right, okay. Yes.
The lighting in that scene... If you get a chance to maybe dial up that, although I don't know if on YouTube it would ever do it justice, but seeing a restoration of this movie, the lighting, the almost solarized black and white, it foreshadows Val Lewton's horror films, specifically Cat People. I mean, it really looks like a mise-en-scene out of a horror film, right down to the way that Carol Lombard's eyes are glowing in the dark. They are the only thing you can really see clearly, and they look like cat eyes in the dark. It's damn spooky, Dean. It really is. Looks like a horror film if you turn off the sound. In fact...
It's Claudette Colbert, by the way. It's not Carol Lombard.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go. Well, wouldn't that be scary? Yeah, I always get the... Okay, so Claudette Colbert. But I said, God, I half expect another pair of eyes to appear under the bed.
Oh, my God.
And Aaron Petrulis, who was watching it with us, said, yeah, it would be, you know, like the clown from It. And then I went, oh, my God, how Have they not done that? The name of the movie is It Happened One Night.
Night. Oh, there's your mashup.
Or how are those not the sequels, for crying out loud? Like, instead of It Chapter 2 or whatever they're calling it, just it. A couple weeks ago, I talked about the Judy Holliday, Jack Lemmon comedy. It Should Happen to You. I mean,
right.
The how about the clown from It terrorizing and murdering nothing but cheerleaders or dance team competitors, and you could call it Bring It On. There are no shortages of them, and I can't. And see, this is why I'm just dogged by cunning foresight.
Exactly.
I don't know if that means what I think it means.
I don't know either.
All right. Speaking of spooky films of a certain vintage, I've been dying to ask you, have you ever caught 1962's Carnival of Souls?
Yes. That's the one with the organ player, right?
Yes.
Yes. I loved this one. This one was freaky, actually. It's not scary. It's freaky.
Yeah, throughout. It's endlessly freaky. It's unremittingly freaky, inspired by a road trip that the director, Herc Harvey, who made industrial and training educational films there in Kansas. It was the only feature film he made, and he was driving back from Los Angeles to Kansas, and on his way past the Great Salt Lake, saw the old abandoned Salt Air Pavilion, and that inspired the movie, and he showed up, and he went to the writer at the studio there, and he said, "Hey, would you like to write a screenplay? And all I need to know that it will contain is a scene at the end where all these undead dance in this huge pavilion at Salt Air Pavilion, and that's how a movie was born." But you're right. The plot follows Mary Henry, a young woman whose life is disturbed after a car accident she's in. She relocates to the Great Salt Lake area, where she finds herself unable to assimilate with the locals and unable to perform her duties as the organist at a church there.
Right. That's exactly it. And it's actually, if I wasn't as closely following David Lynch, I would say this is the precursor to Eraserhead in terms of its freaky tone and in terms of that stillness and that unsettling. And it's funny that you say he was making industrial films, because there is a quality of frankness to the imagery that you get in industrial films, right? You never try doctor your when you're talking about zinc, you know, in an industrial short. You have this sort of flat lighting. And all of Carnival Souls, as I remember, is kind of that kind of flat black and white to grays, you know, going off. So
you know, you know of which you speak, Dean Haglund. This movie, filmed in Lawrence, Kansas and Salt Lake City, was shot for a budget of $33,000.
Yes.
And it used many guerrilla filmmaking techniques, many of the educational training techniques. Like, there's a wonderful scene in a department store where she's trying clothes on, and she has this otherworldly experience where no one can see or hear her, and she can't hear them anymore. She can only hear a particular sound that leads her somewhere. And they were able to shoot in that department store by just paying off the employees who were there at the time. They never went to management. They never went to the owners.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Here's $100 to do what you normally do.
Just keep doing it. Yeah. It did not gain widespread attention at the time.
No, at the time.
It was originally released only as a double feature with The Devil's Messenger in 1962. But it has developed a large cult following, is often screened at, you know, film and Halloween festivals, is a regular on the Turner Classic Movies at that time of year, and has been cited by critics and film scholars for its cinematography, its foreboding atmosphere, its organ score by Gene Moore, and it has been declared as a wide-ranging influence by numerous filmmakers, most significantly David Lynch and George Romero. And damn if this does not seem a direct precursor to Night of the Living Dead.
Absolutely. In terms of the not just the black and white flat quality, but the pacing of it to me is like, because it's so slowed down and so spread out and you don't actually know where the movie's going, that sort of feels how the first Day of the Dead went too. It's like, you got these slow walking zombies, but where's this thing ultimately going? And, you know, there's no definitive first, second, or third act in a lot of these things.
You just described what many guests felt about the engagement party last night. They would look at Lily and me in our makeup and say, well, we've got these slow-moving zombies, but where is this thing going?
Was that the toast?
One last bit about this that you may not know, but so Mary, what was her? I forget the character.
Mary Henry?
Yeah. Played by Candace Hillegoss, who did a couple other movies. But she is stalked throughout the movie by one particular ghoulish stranger who keeps turning up. And that ghoulish stranger is the director, Herc Harvey.
No, is it?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
So that's kind of fun. That's a fun little fun. So another, you know, it's Halloween's coming up. So I like catching. Right. And that's the thing is, no matter how many horror films you've seen, there are always others out there to discover. And
right.
And some of which get better as time advances, right? Because they may not be how movies scare people at the time, but there's something so intrinsic about them that really doesn't let them completely fade into oblivion. And like you said about, you know, maybe that's why Carnival of Souls didn't have a chance to be a big breakout at the time, because it wasn't maybe particularly scary. But it is incredibly haunting.
Yes.
So that brings me to, and I had been surprised that I never saw this, because you know I'm a big fan of this guy's work, especially in the 80s, but I'd never seen John Carpenter's The Fog.
You never?
No. His first film after the huge smash success of Halloween. Halloween at that time, and until Blair Witch Project, the most successful independent film of all time. And The Fog is still surprisingly a low budget and an independent film, but shot in widescreen. So that it wouldn't look like an indie independent film. The cinematography on this is so good. There are shots, again, mise en scène, the setups, the use of shadows, the use of atmosphere is truly worthy of Hitchcock.
Yeah. And when you think about the difficulty of just saying this out loud, we're going to shoot fog. The idea of shooting basically what is a light mist or a smoke as a thing that you fear requires not just ingenuity on your DP, but all the crew has to come together. How do you light fog? How do you possibly show fog where it is and where it isn't? How do you separate those things? All of those technical questions are achieved in this movie. And it's really fantastic.
And, you know, there's something in the fog, right? And I won't get into all the funny ad lines about it. what the hell is in the fog? But there's something in there, obviously. But the fog itself actually becomes a true character in it.
Yeah.
And not an effect. It becomes a character. And that's what's really cool about how they're doing it. And so much of it is practical, right? Which is what's really fun. And what allows for it, instead of it being a CGI fog, you know, it's men creating it, women creating it. And that gives it a bit of a personality, interestingly enough. But so I love that. And I love, as you know, when locations get to become a character. And I love female-driven stories. And here's a movie. The leads are Adrienne Barbeau, Janet Leigh, and Jamie Lee Curtis.
Yeah.
And Adrienne Barbeau, who was married to Carpenter, it was the first film they did together. It was her first big screen role. She'd been on the TV series Maude all those years. But Adrienne Barbeau, you know, she had a brief period of time on the big screen, but I don't think she got the big screen career that really she deserved, because she was pretty damn good, actually. But so the story is about this strange glowing fog that sweeps over a small coastal town in California, bringing with it the vengeful ghosts of mariners who were killed in a shipwreck 100 years earlier. All right. And
right.
It was a fair size hit. A remake was made in 2005. And it's got so many charms to it. But here
right.
to me is why it doesn't work. One of the reasons, but one of the main reasons structurally that it doesn't work and doesn't have the impact that Halloween does. Halloween set on one night. The timeline of the fog is so hinky because this stuff starts one night and you hear about how on the 100th anniversary, blah, 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 this is going to happen. But
right.
then the next night at midnight to one is when all the shit goes down. Well, why, why does it come, fail, and then come back the next night? I mean,
and then it does reconnaissance.
And then
no?
we have to go through the day, the rather banal day with everything. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I understood. And
yeah.
it's not that the stuff during the day isn't fun or that you should fast forward or whatever, but it's just, it doesn't have that kind of time lock precision.
Yes.
That is sealed in. You're sealed into Halloween. And
right.
And so it as a result,
gives
it doesn't quite it doesn't quite hit
yeah.
the mark. Air is
I
let
agree.
Out of the
I
balloon.
Agree.
Yeah.
Totally. You release that tension by the day coming. If you just encapsulated that all in the one night, I guess I don't know what possible narrative function that was doing. Now you mentioned that.
Yeah,
because in my mind it happened all in one night, but you're right, it was two nights.
And this is one of the big things, right? You can be the most talented filmmaker with a great cast, and you can make wonderful, wonderful choices everywhere across the board. But boy, if something doesn't work structurally, there's no fixing it.
That's right. The structure is the foundation. If your house has no foundation, it falls in.
Screenplays are structure. That's what they are. Everything else
yeah.
can be. Changed and fixed, but the structure needs to work. One thing that I found really amusing, produced by Deborah Hill, you know, and Deborah Hill produced all of most of Carpenter's movies, wrote this with him, wrote and produced Halloween with him back when
right.
she was his longtime girlfriend. So I love this about John Carpenter. Interesting, you know, because you think about, you know, tough guy movies and everything, and I don't know much about his personal life, really, but it is interesting that he also made these, you know, these female-driven films, and it would seem that he seemed like a good guy to work with for women, because
yeah.
after all, his ex-girlfriend stays as producer in his new movie starring his new wife.
Yeah,
I mean,
you got to say that aimed at amicably.
Amicably, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, or
the concept of which troubles you so much you can't even get the word out.
Let's not go into our.
Yeah,
exes.
Let's not do. Let's not dip
after your engagement party. Of
are
all
you
things,
saying?
That up.
Are you saying that we shouldn't go into the X-Files? Is that what you're saying? Of all, I can totally understand your reticence.
Oh yeah. Okay.
All right. Hey, switching gears though to a film no less haunting in its own way than A Carnival of Souls. I finally watched the documentary that we've been talking about on and off for the last couple of years, Dawson City: Frozen Time.
Oh, you did. Where did you find this thing?
Turner Classic Movies aired it because the film went a release straight to Criterion Collection after its theatrical. And
right.
Bill Morrison, a man who just is masterful at using archived and found material and creating movies out of it, directs this documentary based on there are a couple of modern clips and some file footage from the 70s. He finds some news footage from the 70s of this cache of frozen films being uncovered. And then he
right.
does some modern interviews at the very end with the man who found it and his wife and a couple other people. But the bulk of this film is to tell the story of the Yukon Gold Rush town, Dawson City, Yeah. It's foundation all the way from it being originally a native tribe village to a town of 40,000 3 years later, to a town of less than 1,000 12 years after that. Entirely through photos taken by locals and from silent film footage found on site.
And, amazing.
And there is no way for me to describe how affecting this movie is, except to say that along with the documentary Los Angeles Plays itself, I would be happy to have these films playing by me nonstop, 24/7 every day for the rest of my life. They're hypnotic. They are transporting. There's more that you can learn. But I learned so much about the Yukon Gold Rush from this, but also about Hollywood history. Dear God, in 1898, who's there? Alex Pantages is there.
Pantages himself, yes.
Yes. Sid Grauman is
Sid
there.
Sid Grauman.
He's a newsboy. He's a newsboy.
He's selling, he sold newspapers for $50 that he got delivered. He sold it to the general store, and then the general store would then charge a quarter, and he would stand up and read the newspaper aloud so that he got his money back for paying for the $50 that Sid got the delivery of the newspaper up to Dawson City. And from that money, then they went to San Francisco and started a movie house.
Charlie Chaplin was there. And now I want to go back and watch The Gold Rush again, because now suddenly, okay, that now a totally different context.
And, totally.
So he's there. Jack London, famous poets are there. It's incredible. It's also the history of the founding of Hollywood. It's the history of the film business itself. It's the history.
Yeah, and vaudeville, because they were bringing in entertainment and showgirls for all of these miners that were up there, because there was nothing to do. You would drink and there'd be dancing and they bring in girls. But Sid Grauman's dad was an entertainment booker. So he was bringing in all these vaudeville talents that would come up there and make money that way. So after he failed as a gold miner,
Dawson City becomes a major center of global enterprise. Look, a certain Fred Trump makes his fortune there. The entire Trump family fortune comes out of Dawson City in 1898,
where
Fred Trump opens, of course he does, a brothel. And that's how the family fortune begins.
Isn't that not ironic?
Yeah.
It's
so
obvious.
The family's work has not changed.
Ah, bzing, patow. Said we wouldn't get political.
And so anyway, and then the town is utterly forgotten by time. And I'm ashamed to know. I know the Yukon Gold Rush, but I did not know the history of this town, and I'm flummoxed that I do not. You know, like all the references. I grew up in California. Jack London is a huge figure there. Yeah, there's reference in the books to, he attempted to make his way to the Gold Rush, got sick, came back. That's it. You know, there's nothing. I'm stunned that I didn't know it. And it's a fascinating history. It's a history of the world. It's history of war. It's the history of munitions. It's the history of show business. And but then this town gets forgotten by time until basically a second gold mine is discovered in the 70s. Think of it. They're unearthing this gold mine of these lost films. And when we say lost films, Dawson City was the end of the line, the end of the distribution chain. And it wasn't worth the money because there was no television, there was no ancillary distribution. It wasn't worth the money for the studios to pay freight to have the film sent back. So the order was destroy them. And there were basically two ways to do that. You could burn them because it was nitrate stock. It was easy to burn. But people started complaining like this, inhaling this smoke and being near this fire is dangerous. So the other thing they did, of course, was dump them in the Yukon River.
Right.
And then they began to get worried about pollution of that. So then it was, let's just bury these under the ice. And that's what happened. And the thing is, because up to 75%, right, of all silent films have been utterly and irrevocably lost. There are no prints, no copies, no negatives left. Most of the films that were uncovered in this underground icy vault were long thought to be lost films.
Lost films.
And
that's
some of these look amazing. I am so desperate to get to see these films. I mean, what the clips that they show from some of these films, some of these look better than any silent films I have ever seen.
Because they wouldn't have all the scratches and everything on it too, right? Because
played once. I don't mean they look better in that sense. I mean they look better in terms of the acting, the production design, the cinematography. It's some of the finest work I have ever seen. And no, there's a lot of water damage. So that appears, but it only appears in a way that enhances the effectiveness of this film. I can't say enough about this. Dean, you have to see this, but I encourage everyone to see this. If you love history, if you love film, there's nothing not to love about this. And I was actually thinking, you know, next year, at the end of next year, we do our top 10 films, obviously.
Yeah.
But we're doing our top 10 films of the decade. We're already to that point at the end of next year. I want to break that up into two shows. And I want us to celebrate documentaries the way they deserve to be celebrated. I think we should do two decade best of lists. I think we should do the 10 best narrative films and our 10 favorite documentaries of the decade.
Wow. We have production meetings on the air. That's fantastic. I'm in.
Good. I'm glad you're in, Dean.
And I got to see this thing.
So there's four new releases that I want to hit if we can.
Do we have
a little bit of lightning round. If we average a minute a movie, we can do it. All right. Old Man and the Gun is the 2018 recent release American crime comedy film written and directed by David Lowery, based on the true life story of Forrest Tucker, who our good friend Dave Provan always refers to Tucker Smallwood as. He always calls him Forrest Tucker. But Forrest Tucker was a real-life career criminal and prison escape artist. The script is based on David Grand's 2003 article in The New Yorker about him, titled The Old Man and the Gun. And this guy is such a fascinating character because in addition to being gentle, he's just happy. He's just always happy. He's played in the movie in his final screen appearance by Robert Redford. And it is such a wonderful career-capping performance that I encourage everyone to see it. But it's also the kind of movie that I feel like Hollywood hasn't really made well since the 70s. And it offers a really charming performance for Sissy Spacek, who is such a valuable resource who goes underutilized in modern age.
I agree.
A wonderful co-starring performance from Casey Affleck. Danny Glover is in a key supporting role. Someone who steals every scene he's in, who's just delicious in it, is Tom Waits. It's a very, very charming character comedy, and again a wonderful career capper for actor Robert Redford.
Can't wait to see it.
A film that I was so eager to see, and I finally had to wait a while to see it so that I could temper my expectations once I heard that the film would not live up to my hope for it. But was the new feature film from Drew Goddard, the man behind the excellent season one of Daredevil, and the movie that Dean Haglund loved, Cabin in the Woods.
Oh, yes.
And this is Bad Times at the El Royale.
Oh, yeah. Tell me about that.
An American neo-noir thriller written, produced, and directed by Drew Goddard. And see, that might be the problem a little bit, because as we know, his collaborator on Cabin in the Woods was Joss Whedon. So you've got a wonderful collaboration here. And you'll remember, if I can describe this correctly, is it fair to say that Cabin in the Woods utilized a really fascinating deconstruction-reconstruction motif? It deconstructed all the tropes of modern horror.
Yes.
And then reconstructed them through this lens of coming up with a metaphor that explains why horror itself serves a cultural purpose.
Yes, absolutely. That you go deeper into its psychology and then restate that psychology as a explicit need.
Yeah,
as it were.
Yeah, and
right?
then that need becomes manifest in a rather delightful
metaphor. That becomes the driving force of the third act, is that need has to be fulfilled. It's really cool.
So Bad Time at the El Royale follows a similar deconstruction, reconstruction motif, but without any soul to it. Because there's no point. What's the point?
Yeah.
There's never any point why these tropes matter, why they're meaningful. There's no there.
No. Oh, that's odd.
And this is why, clever construction and deconstruction and reconstruction gets really tiring if it's not revelatory of something.
Right.
It's the adage of, you can tell an interesting story, and maybe you can tell an interesting story in an interesting way, and boy, isn't that wonderful. But telling an uninteresting story in an interesting way only goes so far.
That's true. Wow. Okay, off my list.
Then, penultimately, I saw Green Book, and I was really dreading this. Now, the Green Book, for people who don't know, fascinating history. And I learned about this through my charity work with the Breakfast Club Foundation in efforts to preserve Americana and Route 66 and its history and its legacy. The Green Book was a guide that was published from the 20s until the 60s by Mr.
Right.
Green, an African-American post office employee, mailman in New York, who created a guide that basically was a guide, a safety guide for if you were going to travel while black. And it was a guidebook to give safe passage across these United States to African Americans. Where could you stay? Where could you eat? What roads could you ride on? What towns could you not drive through after dark because it was illegal to be African American after dark in many of these places? So I thought, oh, this would be an excellent documentary. And then I find out there's a documentary being made. And I thought, oh, well, this would be an extra narrative film. And then I find out that of all people, Peter Farrelly, yes, the Farrelly
the Farrelly Brothers?
The Farrelly Brothers, yeah. Is making a movie called The Green Book. And I go, oh, for fuck's sake, really? That guy? And then, of course, by all means, this movie should be directed by a white guy. And better still, it should star a white guy. Viggo Mortensen should absolutely be the star of a movie called Green Book. But because of my interest in this, I knew I had to see it. And oh my God, love this movie.
What?
Had no idea, because I didn't want to know anything about it going in. I had no idea that it was actually... It's called The Green Book because, yes, in the movie they use The Green Book a couple of times. But it's really about a true life friendship that developed between the legendary musician and scholar, Dr. Don Shirley, an African-American man, and the Italian-American man, the maitre d' at the Copacabana, which had shut down for a couple of months, who he hired to be his driver and basically his bodyguard on a tour through the South. And it's the real life friendship that developed between them as the result of this experience. This movie is so funny. It is such high energy. The opening scenes with Bobby Rydell performing at the Copa. Oh my God, I wanted to live in that movie.
Wow.
And the performance by Viggo Mortensen, he gained so much weight for this. It's maybe his best. And here's an actor that I've been discussing kind of since the beginning of Chilpak Hollywood Hour, when I discovered him on the 4400, Mahershala Ali, who is now an Oscar winner, who plays Don Shirley. And it is a heartbreaking performance. I mean, my God, I actually found myself tearing up, in part because I actually got the opportunity to work for Mr. Shirley at UCLA. And what a beautiful, sad, lonely man this man was. And Mahershala Ali captures something so indelible and so just breathtaking about this man's spirit. It is a phenomenal performance. The film had its premiere at the Toronto International Film Festival, where it won the People's Choice Award. Eric Mark was in attendance and said that it got this huge standing ovation, which, of course, is kind of common in Hollywood, where when they have these screenings, everybody sits on their hands during the movie and then gives a standing ovation because the stars are in attendance. But at the Toronto International Film Festival, this reception was quite something, and it left Viggo Mortensen speechless. He whispered to his co-star, Linda Cardellini, who plays his wife, I've never seen this happen. It's spectacular. It's going to be up for all the major awards. It's Green Book. So we are over time, but there is another movie that opened that we really need to mention. And that is a movie that we made
called
The Lady Killers. Is now available in North America, U.S. and Canada, on demand across a wide variety of platforms.
Wide. 12, last I counted.
More than that, but I haven't sent you the links because they're only available if you subscribe to those. The links are only available. You can't share the links to non-subscribers like Comcast and Time Warner Cable. But the name of the movie is The Lady Killers. And I was thinking that perhaps... next week, we could spend some time talking about that movie, especially in context now of how, with each passing day, it seems more and more to be a movie of the era.
Isn't that amazing?
Instead of being a movie that was greeted with, you know, this kind of misogyny doesn't exist anymore when we first finished it.
Right.
So
we nailed it there.
If nothing else, time's up on that particular assessment of the movie. So in the interim, everyone within the sound of my voice, please avail yourself of the website, theladykillersmovie.com, theladykillersmovie.com. Watch the brand new trailer. Enjoy the brand new artwork. Learn a little bit about the film if you want to, so that you can maybe better enjoy our conversation about it next week. If you want to see it on demand, you can find the links to many different ways to do that. It will be coming to DVD in a couple weeks. We'll be setting up screenings of the film at various cities around the country throughout the fall and into the winter. But at the very least, you can learn about the film at the website and enjoy our conversation next week.
Fantastic. Till then.
Yeah.
Do we have to say everything?
No. Nah. Till then,
we're over time.
Who are you?
Yes. You get some sleep.
No,
I'm Dean Haglund.
You're Dean Haglund.
Yes.
And I'm Phil Larenas. And this is the hair of the dog that bit me.
Bless God.
Spoiler alert.